on the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The Catholic Church in China is in the news as the Vatican continues to reach for a diplomatic breakthrough with the communist government. Some have questioned if the Vatican surrendered too much in these negotiations. We talked to Register correspondent Victor Gaitan for details. Then we take a look back at the busy month of January. And more than simply looking at the top headlines, we recap what we think were the most meaningful stories. That's on Register Radio with me, Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host for Register Radio. And I'm actually joined in studio by Matthew Bunsen, my co-host and Register senior editor. It's great to see you face-to-face, Matthew.
Always. Yeah, it's a rare treat to be able to come down and join you in studio here.
Well, my partner, 2018 has started off with a bang, hasn't it?
Well, it has. We had the March for Life. We had the Walk for Life. We had a number of major legislative votes on life. We also had President Trump's State of the Union address. So there's a lot to cover. But we want to do more than just talk about headlines. We want to look at some unique perspectives regarding that.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, we have someone on the line with us, Victor Gaitan, who is one of the Register's correspondents on international affairs. And Victor has also covered the church in China for a foreign affairs magazine, as well as many other great Catholic topics for Foreign Affairs magazine. Victor, it's so good to have you with us to talk about these Vatican-China relations.
Thank you, Jeanette. Very nice to be with you.
So, Victor, this has been in the news, but I feel as though we should just give our readers our listeners a little background as to what the purpose of negotiations with the Holy See and the Chinese government are all about. What's the effort here?
Right. Well, Jeanette and Matthew, we've been following intention, the working of these negotiations, the dialogue between the Holy See and Beijing since John Paul II, whose goal has been the same, to bring unity to the Catholic Church in China, which has been divided into two communities, one which is state-controlled, state-sanctioned, and the other which functions and has been functioning beyond government control. We know that there are an estimated 12 million Catholics who have lived through many forms of persecution in China in the last decades. The specific task that the Vatican has been following is to normalize the process for selection of bishops in order to protect the essential papal role within a political framework that, given its nature, rejects and opposes so-called foreign interference.
And how is it happening now? How are the bishops actually appointed now?
At the current situation in China is today is ad hoc. When priests learn that they are being considered for episcopal appointment by the government, most seek approval from the Vatican and manage following such unwritten procedure to get joint approval. There are approximately 110 bishops in China today. About 70 are jointly approved by Rome and Beijing, and some 30 are solely endorsed by the Holy See. Only 6 bishops are state-appointed bishops, whose status is now reviewed and under negotiation by the Vatican. But what Rome is looking, what the Holy See is looking, is at reconciliation between Beijing and the Holy See. And this has been a priority for Pope Francis from the beginning of his pontificate. In fact, what he is doing, Pope Francis, he is building on the progress which was made under Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI.
Well, Victor, what exactly did that progress entail with Pope Benedict?
If we can talk of progress...
That's a good point.
We would like to talk then to people who go to China regularly, and I happen to have been able to talk to such people, and this includes the newly appointed Bishop of Hong Kong, whom I was able to interview last November in Hong Kong, Bishop Michael Yu Ming, who was appointed by Pope Francis last year, as well as Cardinal Tong. There is one other cardinal in Hong Kong that we hear less about, and priests and religious men and women who go to China regularly from Hong Kong, from Taiwan and other places. It is very interesting to listen to their accounting of the relationship that is built between regular people, Christian Catholics, Chinese priests who are not distinguished in China between underground or officially sanctioned priests. It is the bishops that are in question.
So let me repeat back what I'm hearing you saying, and of course I've loved the reports that you've been able to give us from actually visiting with people and speaking to people there. It sounds like that trip was really amazing. And but what I'm hearing is that they do not really identify themselves as, let's say, underground Catholics or government Catholics.
Right. There is one church in China, I am told, repeatedly by such people. It is the community, the Catholic community, which is one part is sanctioned by the government. It is controlled by the government at the level of bishops. And then there is the other community which does not recognize the government. But there is one Catholic church.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, would you mind recapping for us, like, what happened this week? Why was it in the news? Why were there tensions, at least seeming to be tensions, over these relations?
Yeah, and Victor can jump in, because I know this is something he covers very closely. But at the heart of it is a deep worry on the part of some regarding China. In particular, the Bishop Emeritus of Hong Kong, Cardinal Zen, who has expressed his concern regarding these negotiations for a while now, especially the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And he apparently met directly with Pope Francis and asked him about these negotiations. And what's interesting is that they raised the name Joseph Menzenti. Now, that's a name that a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with, but that was a Hungarian cardinal who faced persecution and actually had to live in the U.S. Embassy in Hungary for a number of years. And I think there's worry about a similar situation developing in China. And so Cardinal Zen was surprised regarding Pope Francis's response, and it prompted the Vatican to issue a very strong statement that Pope Francis is aware of what's going on.
That's right. Greg Burke, the Vatican spokesperson, did issue that statement and said, no, he knows full well what's going on. Victor, what do you make of this, this controversy that has emerged this week in the news?
Regarding the opposition, the strong statements made by Cardinal Zen, is that it's not new. This is not a new terrain for the Holy See.
Mm-hmm.
In their communication dealings with communist countries during the Cold War, for instance, anywhere from Poland to Hungary to Czechoslovakia to Cuba to Romania, and more recently with Vietnam. It's not new terrain. We can think of the way I took the Holy Father's remark regarding Cardinal Joseph Menzenti is that, and then we can extend that to the Ukrainian primate Joseph Slipy and the Czech Archbishop Joseph Beran, is that the Church has not suppressed their views. But today, and since the time they were pulled out from the respective communist countries, they have been there today celebrated. Yet they have, for the purpose of negotiation with the communist countries, that there was that sacrifice that was made, the compromise that was necessary in view of the Holy See, in order to bring about the protection of the Catholic Church as an institution and the faithful in those countries.
Now, Victor, we only have a minute left, but I want to know, where do you see it going from here?
From what we know, there are, again, I see the absolutely that same approach that was applied in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, even in Cuba during the John Paul II's pontificate, that on one hand, the Holy See is making some concessions and demanding that a senior bishop who is perceived as a controversial figure by the government, that bishop step down and be replaced with an auxiliary, which is approved by both Beijing and the Holy See, that this is the pattern. This is the pattern that is followed.
Victor Gaitan, our senior correspondent at The Register, who covers foreign affairs for us and also writes for Foreign Affairs magazine. Victor, thanks so much for being with us today. We're very grateful for your reporting.
Thank you, Janet and Matthew.
When we come back, Matthew and I will discuss all the headlines in what is already a busy 2018, as well as the stories not to miss. You know the ones that don't get enough attention, the ones worth reading. This is Register Radio, on EWTN Radio.
Father Wade Menezes talks about the National Catholic Register.
As the National Catholic Register celebrates its 90th anniversary, I think that says a lot about the publication. It works. It's solidly Catholic. It presents the teachings of the Church, unabashedly so, and also guides its readers to be even more solidly Catholic themselves. One of the major effects that I think the Register has on its readers is that it elevates the intellect. Whether it be a faith item or a news item, it presents the news and the faith item in a very balanced way. One thing that the Register can never be accused of is being too far left or too far right. It is solidly Catholic, right in line with the Chair of Peter, and I think that says a lot about the Register.
For a 6-issue free trial of the National Catholic Register, go to ncregister.com and click on the 6 free issue banner, or call 800-421-3230 for your 6 free issues. And as you await your first issue, enjoy some of our online content.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back to Register Radio. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm here in studio in Birmingham with Matthew Bunsen, my co-host. Matthew, it's, of course, good to have you in the room here with me. And we're taking this opportunity, since we're together, to actually talk about what we've been doing the last month. Very busy first month of 2018.
It has. Right at the top of the show, we listed just a couple of stories. We had the March for Life. We had Donald Trump's first State of the Union speech. We had a couple of votes on life, including the partial birth abortion ban. We'll get more into that.
Right.
But what's interesting is, and I have a question for you, actually, as editor-in-chief. I never have a chance to interview you.
I'm on the spot.
We may start a trend here. But when you're looking at a huge news cycle like this, as a team, but especially as our team leader, how do you begin the process of deciding, okay, let's focus on this and this and this?
Well, one of the things we always think about, and you know this because we meet every day virtually as a team, because our team's spread all over the country. But as we bring forward the news of the day, we always have to ask the question, is there anything that we can add to that story from a Catholic perspective? Mm-hmm. If it's already being covered and there's not that much that we can add to it, we'll pick up the story from our partners, Catholic News Agency, right? But we always have to figure out what's the unique angle that we can cover. So that's the very first thing I look for. I love covering this kind of stuff. It's the news. It's sort of our bread and butter. But honestly, my favorite thing is to highlight people being church, right? I mean, people right. who are on the path to eternity, I like to say, people who are just choosing to do good, or sometimes people choosing to do things that shouldn't be done, that we need to highlight, because it shows the truth of our journey towards eternity. And so that's my favorite kind of thing to cover, are sort of the good news stories and the stories that no one else has. But first, we're talking about news, at least on this show. And I wanted to turn to you because the news of this week has been important already. Mm-hmm. You covered Donald Trump's State of the Union, his first State of the Union address, which many commentators said was surprisingly positive in tone. And across the aisle, they seemed to agree that it was positive. Of course, there were certain key points where his rhetoric slipped right back into the same kind of rhetoric it has been all year. But what were your highlights? What were the highlights for you?
Yeah, it was clear that politically the president recognizes two things. The first is that this is going to be a complicated year, that he needs mm-hmm. The assistance, the cooperation from the Democrats in order to get a lot of things passed, most notably his immigration bill,
right.
An authentic kind of real immigration reform. The other, though, is that he has an economy that's taking off. By
that's right.
Every barometer that we have, the economy is doing much better than it has been. And he went to some pains last night to frame that as one of the central arguments for the midterm elections. But it also gave him a certain amount of political high ground in mm-hmm. how he's going to deal with the Democrats. And I think that's something that the Democrats are going to have to deal with from their standpoint as a caucus, because they themselves are very divided. We saw that last night with four different responses to the president's speech. We had the official one from mm-hmm. Joe Kennedy III, but then we had an unofficial one from Maxine Waters that appeared on BET. We had Bernie Sanders sort of piping in from the socialist side. And then we had a recently elected Virginia delegate who offered the Spanish language response.
So what's going on with all this?
What it means is that Charles Schumer, who's a minority leader, has a more complicated job than many of us think he does.
Right.
Because the Senate is like herding cats, as they famously say, to begin with, but trying to pull all of this together. However, and this is for Trump a real complication going forward, too, all of those disparate groups are united behind one thing. They really dislike him.
Sure. Right. Well, you also see a lack of unity on the Republican side, especially on this issue of immigration. So how did immigration fare this week? Because it wasn't the only thing this week that came out on immigration.
Well, this week we have a real push regarding DACA. The president seems mm-hmm. willing to negotiate. He laid out four key points. But the problem with the 4 points is that at least three of them are dead on arrival, as far as a lot of the Democrats are concerned. That includes the wall. That includes chain migration. And, of course, the visa lottery. So within the Republican caucus, there's a lot of opposition to at least one or two of those. And among the Democrats, there's opposition to three of those.
Immigration is not an easy topic right now. Our staff, our readers, our listeners have many different views on this immigration problem. It's extremely complex. I feel as though it seems like people talk about it as if it's new, but I remember more than 10 years ago when I was working at the Archdiocese of Denver, this being a central part of that year in 2006 it was. I mean, it was just a huge push, and there was a push for, you know, these certain legislative pieces that just never went anywhere. So what we're seeing here, I guess I just want to remind people, it is not new. I mean, we are not in a new situation on immigration.
Well, and you can even go back to the 1980s, a very controversial decision on the part of the Reagan administration to grant amnesty to mm-hmm. a lot of immigrants. Who are living and working in the United States. And to this day, there are people in California who swear that that's why California turned so deep blue politically.
Mm-hmm.
But you also have a lot of Republicans who to this day also feel it was the right thing to do. Reagan had the best intentions of it. But it's a conversation, as you say, that's a long-standing one.
Sure. I mean, you're living in the Beltway. You live in D.C. I mean, is there any real idea of where this is heading? On immigration?
I think there's going to be a lot of haggling. We have already seen that the Democrats mm-hmm. were willing to shut down the government over this DACA issue.
Mm-hmm.
They immediately, I think, regretted that, again, politically. And you always have to look at things from the political standpoint. The key here, I think, is that we're in an election year. We are in mm-hmm. a midterm coming up in November. And I think there's a lot of calibrating. I think there's a lot of studying right now as to what they can get away with and what kind of a deal they can actually organize. It won't enrage or isolate their bases.
All right. I really want to get into that good news, the kind of news I love to talk about. But, of course, we still have a few more highlights from this past month. And one is the Senate vote on the 20-week abortion ban. This failed on January 29th. What happened?
Well, as happens in the U.S. Senate, you have to clear a series of procedural votes. And in order to get past that main hurdle, in order to basically shut down what's called cloture to end debate, you have to get 60 votes. And everyone knew going in, including Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, that they were not going to have those 60 votes, in large measure because of the sheer power of the abortion lobby.
Mm-hmm.
What is tragic about this is how many Catholic senators voted essentially to uphold a partial birth abortion.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Including, we have to note, someone who came very close to becoming vice president of the United States, and that's Tim Kaine, senator from Virginia.
Yeah, that's right. It's really it's a disaster when we can't get this moved forward. So again, it's a part of our prayers, and it's a topic we'll continue.
The vote, though, comes just days after the March for Life.
That's true.
Which was an immense experience for anyone who's ever been to it. And I encourage everyone who's listening, if you haven't been to the March for Life, make a point to come to this one or the one on the West Coast or the Walk for Life.
That's right. It's been many years since I've actually been to the Walk for Life in D.C. I've never been on to the West Coast one, but that was just last weekend. And we had some great coverage about that, people on the ground at the Walk for Life. And one of my favorite stories covering the marches that happened all over the country, because we really tried to give a little attention to marches everywhere, was an interview done with Karen Gaffney. Elizabeth Defner, one of our reporters out in Orange County, interviewed Karen Gaffney, who is a woman who has Down syndrome. But she's just amazing. She's swam the English Channel. She has an honorary doctorate, and she goes around the country talking to people about the dignity of life, especially the dignity of people who have challenges like Down syndrome, or blessings like Down syndrome, I should say. What about your favorite stories of this last month?
Well, probably my absolute favorite story for this last month, and this tells you everything you need to know about me, was from Kevin Knight, who, of course, is one of our editors. It basically asks the question, how do you count a crowd size? And he looked at different ways that you can estimate crowd sizes, because there's always this back and forth, especially in Washington, D.C., is how big the crowd was for anything. And, of course, the organizers always say, we had 1 million people. And the Park Service used to give us a fairly good estimate, but everyone complained that that was now too political. So we don't really know how to estimate crowd sizes,
right,
at least scientifically. And Kevin looked at a series of questions about what you need to do to try to guesstimate, especially because the media tends to increase the size of groups that it likes,
right,
and decrease the size of groups that it doesn't like. For example, he noted that the march in Denver had several thousand people for certain, and yet I think that local news media reported several dozen people.
They say reported dozens of people. So it's pretty. This is absolutely a wonderful blog by Kevin. I'm so glad
it was one of our
it.
Most read items too.
It was. I was just going to say that it was a trending item all last month, and for good reason. It just shows sometimes the bias in media to the point of stupidity, honestly. So excellent choice.
The other one that caught my eye definitely, and I know is trending, is an interview with Elvis Gerback, who more than just fun to say his name. He was a quarterback in the National Football League. Actually, was on the San Francisco 49ers in 1994, so he was on the team that won the Super Bowl. Of course, Joe Montana, legendary.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was actually Steve Young was the quarterback for the 49ers for that one. But he was also in the Pro Bowl in 2001 with the Kansas City Chiefs and actually played in a couple of playoff games with them. He has found God, and it's a great interview, especially asking him about what it's like to be a pro athlete.
Absolutely. And of course, we always try to have something about the Super Bowl as that rolls around every year. And his story is a good one. It goes into his love of Eucharistic adoration, which is something you just don't hear from many pro athletes. And so it's definitely worth the read. He travels around the country speaking speaking to high school students and athletes and encouraging them in faith, not only talking, of course, about team building that happens in any kind of sports, but talking about great saints like St. Peter and St. Athanasius and St. Augustine. So, I mean, you just can't get a better role model than somebody like that.
And I have to ask you about Paddington.
Paddington. Oh, it just warms my heart. And somehow it warmed Stephen Graydonis's heart, our film critic, who is sometimes hard to please on cartoons and children's fare. But he absolutely loved Paddington, too. And you know, Paddington 1 is something I've seen. I haven't seen Paddington 2 yet, but it's with young kids at home, it's always good to hear of a film that is worth watching, even for an adult. But Stephen's review is great. I think it's worth reading because not only does it give this movie a good pass, but he's very entertaining in the way he wrote it, and he kind of pokes a little bit at the British style of storytelling. So I love Stephen's review. SDG Reviews Paddington 2 is the name of that. And we are almost out of time here, but is there anything that we have missed?
I don't think so, other than to make note of the fact, and I know this is something we covered, that let's remember that the pro-life movement is global. Mm. And that there's a lot happening around the world, and we're on top of it. Marches in Paris and Australia and elsewhere, especially as this vote in Ireland is
just
coming up.
I'm so glad you brought that up. We've got a story this week that's probably a must-read for everyone's knowledge on pro-life issues around the world. And Ireland's government is looking to repeal a pro-life amendment, and they need our prayers. So. This is all on Register Radio this week. It is great to see you in person. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you, Jeff Burson, our producer, and for all of you who are listening to Register Radio on EWTN Global Radio Network. We are
The National Catholic Register is America's most complete Catholic news source with a comprehensive view of the world from a distinctly Catholic perspective. If it's shaping the world as we know it, you'll find it at ncregister.com.